Does anybody have any questions about things before we get started?
When did these publish about, was it recent or?
He has been publishing in New Yorker for at least 30 years, and most of his books are compilations of what was in New Yorker. He publishes serially, so his book, Rising from the Plains, I think appeared in 3 issues of New Yorker or so. But the Rising from the Plains must have been about 88, something like that. Other kinds of questions? No, yeah.
We were at an elder hospital in Alaska, and they recommended a lady to have marine geologists.
As well. Must be something there.
And we were at one in Bellingham, and it was studying the North Coast, and his name is definitely that person.
He's a magnificent author. I really enjoy, he writes about all kinds of different things, though. I mean, he has a book called The Deltoid Pumpkin Seed, which was about experiments during the 50s to build dirigibles for cargo transport. He has a whole book on that subject. Just all kinds of different things. Okay, plate tectonics. This is a theory that took shape in the 1960s, mid-1960s, but it has its roots really back at the turn of the century, and we'll be backing up to look at some of those roots. Tectonics comes from the root, the Greek root tekto, which means to build. And so what we'll be doing is looking at a theory that allows us to build the features that we see on the surface of the Earth. The term plate is used because what we actually have in plate tectonics is a series of pieces of the surface of the Earth that all move around, and these are called plates. Plates of the outer surface of the Earth that we call the lithosphere. And so that is the origin of this name, but we're going to go back and actually back up to some earlier theories, and continental drift is perhaps the one that most people have heard. And we'll learn that continental drift is now incorporated as a part of plate tectonics, but it was an earlier theory and really quite separate from all of that. I'm reaching a stage where perhaps I need some additional assistance.
I was wondering if we could have more light on you.
Well, we're going to about to have some slides. And so at that point, I'm going to sort of move off to the side, and I may turn on that little light and look at a couple of my notes every now and then. But I think if you wouldn't mind,
yeah,
I'm turning on the slide projector.
I'll be wondering what you look like.
Oh, well, that's the secret. If you really want to know, there's a somewhat lousy picture of me out in the corner. Yeah. There it is. You? Okay. We'll start with what I'm sure to a number of you is quite a familiar picture. This is Mount St. Helens at 8:32 a.m. on May 18, 1980. And I start with this picture because plate tectonics, if nothing else, gives us an explanation for this phenomenon that occurred that day. I also show it because it's really an awfully dramatic event in terms of what happened here in the Northwest recently. But as I said, what we're going to be doing is looking at this concept of plate tectonics and then coming back and looking in some detail at certain areas. And what the theory of plate tectonics says is that we can take the surface of the Earth, and here at this map, maybe a bit confusing at first, there are the outlines of the continents. The different colors represent different plates, these different pieces of the surface of the Earth. And there's different symbols where these different plates meet, and we'll be coming back and talking about what that means. But you can see that there are some plates that are huge, like the Pacific Plate, occupies most of the Pacific Ocean basins. There are some other much smaller plates that are all oceans. There are some other plates, such as the North American Plate, that are a combination of both continents and oceanic crust. And they are, that piece, the entire North American Plate, both the continent and ocean all move as a single piece. And it moves relative to other plates. It's relative to the Pacific Plate, the Eurasian Plate, and so on. And in the case of this area, we're very concerned in terms of how it moves relative to the Juan de Fuca Plate. There are generally considered to be about a dozen major plates on the surface of the Earth, and then beyond that, a number of minor, smaller plates. The Juan de Fuca Plate is quite small, but very important to us as it's here.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
And this may be premature, but in the astronomy, the theory of plate or the astronomy was based on a lot of assumptions and then try to pile up the evidence. The establishment of the plate, are we trying to...
We're going to work back. I was just going to give you a brief summary of sort of what it means so that we can work back and now see how we've come towards this.
But you are starting out with a set of assumptions that that there are those plates. When did that assumption take place? In 1600?
No, in the 1960s.
You sort of said these are the assumptions starting in 1960s on what we know, because to establish that would take a lot of technology.
Right. And what I said is I'm going to give you just a brief summary of what the theory is about and then back up and do this historical march toward it as we've accumulated all sorts of kinds of evidence. Now, the important story for the Northwest is that where these separate pieces, these plates meet, things happen. Within the plate, there may be some sort of small-scale things in terms of geology, but where the plates meet, we have big earthquakes, we tend to have lots of volcanism, and so on. And so that gives us a setting in which we will ultimately work to explain some of these things.
Are those smaller plates called subplates or anything like that?
No. Some of the tiny, tiny ones are called microplates.
Oh, I see.
For example, down here near Easter Island is a very tiny one that doesn't show up on the scale of this map.
And those are pretty well identified then.
Well, the microplates are not as well identified. We're going to see how the plates have been identified in their locations. I'm putting the cart before the horse or something here. Okay. Alfred Wegener, whose name I stuck up here with the date 1912 after it, was a German meteorologist. He was very, very interested in looking at high latitude climates. He actually died in an expedition on Greenland, and I suppose any scientist doing science in their milieu and dying there is not such a bad thing, and it's probably his dream in many ways to live his life in that environment. But along the way, he ended up studying a lot of ancient climate indicators. And we're going to look at some of those on the southern continent, down in the higher latitudes of the southern continent, and some of the story that he pieced together. But one of the first things that he did in looking sort of at global geography was to realize that there was this apparent jigsaw puzzle fit between the continents. Now, this is at the turn of the century, about 1912, that he published a book, although he published it in about 10 different editions over a period of 10 years. And how was it that nobody else had noticed it? Well, that was not the case. Others had noticed it, but we have to realize that the ability to develop maps that showed the correct outline of the continents had taken a long time. And so it couldn't have been until sometime after a number of careful expeditions had been done to chart the outlines of the continents that they really had a good sense of their shape. But by the turn of the century, they had a very good sense. And Alfred Wegener said, well, hey, it looks like these continents fit together. This, I hope, looks like a familiar outline of Africa. Nestled in here is South America, fits very well into this area. Here is North America, nestling right up against what we, in the present day, think of sort of the northwest coast of Africa. And then this is Europe. Now, some other colors that show up on this map, you can see some areas of overlap, such as right here. We can see some other areas where there are gaps, some areas where there are basins, places that we know were not land area at any time in sort of recent geologic history, and by that I mean a couple hundred million years. Now, one of the questions is, well, how do you account for overlap? Well, that's not such a problem here. The Amazon is flowing out. We've built a huge pile of sediments off of the Amazon here. The Congo is flowing out here off of Africa, and again, building a huge pile of sediments that has, in essence, enlarged the continent. But really, the fit is awfully good. This is actually a map that was done in the 1960s using a computer program to move the continents, but Wegener himself really had done the same thing in his sketches and his book. But as I said, his real study was to look at some of the climate indicators. And in looking at some of the southern continents, in particular, we'll see not just South America and Africa, but we'll see some others that fit in down here, he had noticed that this jigsaw puzzle fit could even be given a better analogy, such as a torn newspaper, that not only did the pieces have the same shape, but things had continuity if we connected them up. And this showed up in a lot of different things. One of them were the sort of rock types that were exposed, the structures of the rocks, mountain ranges that sort of came and appeared to end the edge of one continent, in fact, continued onto the other continent when these two pieces were put together, types of rocks that were exposed to the surface, connected up across the continent. He also looked at some of the fossil distribution. These are all fossils that are about 200 million years old, and we find the same fossil on a number of different continents. Well, so what if the continents are now separated by 3,000 or 4,000 miles? Maybe they swam. Well, not all of them were that good swimmers. Some of them were, in fact, terrestrial, such as this land-based reptile. Some of them were plants, and we can see that not only did this plant exist in South America and Africa, but across into Antarctica and Australia. Well, maybe the plants, the seeds were carried by birds. Well, it's a long way from birds. So a lot of arguments put up against this. This was only one of his pieces of evidence to suggest that these continents had, in fact, perhaps stick back together. We see very different organisms living on these continents today, excluding human impact in terms of transporting them back and forth from one continent to another. But how come we had the same ones 200 million years ago and we don't have the same ones today? This was one of the questions that came out of it. He also looked at such things such as the deposits of coal and desert, congealed areas of deserts, and discovered that if the continents were all fit back together again, then these bands, which we in the present day associate with certain latitudes, coal forms at very low latitudes, warm, humid, equatorial, sub-equatorial areas, whereas the deserts are up at about 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south. And if we take the continents and put them in their present-day positions, then these connections don't show up very well. But when we put the continents back using this jigsaw puzzle fit, then we can see the band of deserts is, in fact, continuous. Now, notice that it's tilted relative to the present-day equator, and we'll be able to come back and explain some of that. One of the things that was closest to Wegener's own interest was to look at the evidence of glaciation in the southern continent. And these grooves that we see here on the rocks are called striations. They're grooves that form as glaciers, as masses of ice flow over rocks. In that ice, there are chunks of rock in the form of pebbles and stones and slightly larger ones. And those, as they're dragged across the rock, which is outcropping, leave these grooves. Well, if we look at this, without knowing anything about which way was up and down in this picture, we know one thing. We know that the glacier either flowed this way or this way, and it couldn't have been flowing this way. But if in the case here, we have some topography to help us, then the glacier must have been flowing down. But what Wegener found when he went and looked at the southern continents was that the combination of his information of these striations, which are indicated parallel to these arrows, and then the deposits that are left at the toe of a glacier, these mounds of rock debris, he was able to say, well, look, in South America, a glacier came from out here and was flowing onto the land. Here in Africa, there was some central point, and glaciers were radiating out to them. But again, we go over here to Australia, to India, and glaciers came from the oceans. Well, glaciers don't come from the oceans. The water comes from the oceans, but we need the force of gravity to pull those glaciers down. And he said, well, look what happens when you put all the continents back together. Now all of a sudden you have a source for the ice that we saw on South America, the ice that we saw here in India and Australia, coming here from a central Antarctica. And the combination of all of these different kinds of evidence led Wegener to postulate that the continents had all fit back together again. Here's North America, South America, Africa, Europe, and Asia, into a large continent that he called Pangaea. Gaea, or Gaea, as we now tend to be pronouncing it, is earth or land, and pan means all. And so here was all the lands together. On the opposite side of the earth, if we take and put all the land area together, that land area only covers about a third of the earth, we end up with a huge ocean, which he called Panthalassa, Thalassa being for ocean, so all oceans. And he said, look, These continents must have all been assembled. That explains 200 million years ago all those fossils. It explains the evidence we see from ancient climate indicators like the coal and the deserts and the glaciers and so on. But we know that today the Earth looks like this, with ocean basins separating the different continents. And so Wegener postulated a theory which we have come to call continental drift. And his story was the continents have drifted. He had a lot of evidence to support the fact that the continents must have been assembled together once upon a time. And if they're apart now, then they must have drifted to those locations. And as I said, he published it in a number of different editions about 1912. But his theory had a flaw. All he did was explain that the continents drifted. He said, well, they must move like big ships through the sea. They must just plow through the ocean basins. Well, we know there's rock at the bottom of the ocean basin. So they must have been plowing through the rock at the bottom of the ocean basin. Well, that was difficult for people to accept. It's easy to say, okay, maybe the continents moved, but he had no mechanical way to explain this. The ocean basins are the obstacle in his story. He only dealt with the continents. And his books still sit in the shelves in many libraries, but basically between the time that he proposed them in 1912, 1914, 16, and so on, until the 1960s, this theory was just put away and out of people's minds. It was the problem with the ocean basins and how the continents got through those ocean basins that became the obstacle. Well, the thing that came to be able to answer some of these questions was the study of the ocean basins themselves. And the 1940s were great for the study of oceanography. The technology that was developed during the Second World War to study the floors of the oceans has allowed marine geology to advance by leaps and bounds. Now, the military was interested in studying the shape of the seafloor because they were looking for hiding places. Geologists are just interested in what the shape of that seafloor looks like. And as a result of the devices, particularly ones that we sort of in a general sense call echo sounders, devices that get fastened to the bottoms of ships, they release sound. This sound goes down and bounces off the seafloor, comes back up to the ship to a receiver. And since we know the speed of sound in water, we can figure out how deep that water is by how long it took for that signal to come back. Now, the technology of echo sounding has gone through many permutations. Early on, echo sounding the sound device was a huge explosion. And the 1940s had a lot of leftover explosive material. So marine geologists went out in the late 40s and on into the 50s and simply shoved huge charges of dynamite off the back of a ship. It would explode and the sound could travel down and they could get back their answers. Technology has evolved to the point where we can now release very finely tuned sound signals tuned to just very narrow frequencies, and those can bounce down and back up again and give us the same and in fact much more information without nearly as much risk. Although we do unfortunately still retain sort of the nomenclature that existed from using explosives, the devices that are most often used to study depth and not just the depth of the seafloor, but we can in fact look at some of the layers of sediments beneath, are called both air guns and water guns. And they are devices which either have a pocket of air under pressure in a chamber and it's allowed to explode and it releases certain frequencies of sound, or a vacuum is created in a chamber and as the chamber collapses, it basically implodes and releases sound devices. But the terms air gun and water gun are frightening ones for people to hear. And I'll never forget going to a discussion that was hosted by the Department of Ecology at my university, State Department of Ecology, and people were complaining about studies in Puget Sound and using air guns and water guns. Somebody sort of had to back up and explain that in fact those were not guns that were shooting organisms, although the explosions can be serious enough to damage the very small floating organisms. But in any event, as a result of all of the cruises that had gone out both during the Second World War and then on up in terms of research cruises through the 50s, geologists were able to develop a sense of the shape
Do I have the sense that this, there's nothing for focus here? Just did it.
Okay, that's pretty good.
It's okay.
That's pretty good.
Now, I always have to give an initial explanation of this map. This was a very creative piece of art generated by a very famous marine geologist who was at Columbia University at the Lamont Geologic Observatory, and his very able-bodied technical assistant and artist. This is a rendition of the Earth if we drain the ocean basin, but it's an artist's rendition. It is based on thousands, if not millions, of points of data where we've made measurements of the depth of the seafloor, but it is truly an artist's rendition. Now, scientifically, we generate maps where we simply take and contour the depth, just as we contour elevation in topographic maps. But this gives us a sense that I think allows more people to stand back and visualize what these features are. There were two sets of very dominant features that began to appear as geologists assembled this data of the depth of the seafloor in the study that we called the symmetry. One of these was a feature, and unfortunately this is out of focus, but we'll have a close-up on the Atlantic later on, that is a ridge that runs down symmetrically through the middle of the Atlantic Ocean between the continents, rising to its shallowest depths that are somewhere on the order, and I do all of these numbers in meters, and I do it in my classes to make my students learn the metric system, but about 2,500 meters. So we're looking at something that is
8,000.
Okay. And then going down to the average depths of the ocean basins that are on the order of, say, 4,000 meters. And this ridge, not only do we find it rising from the seafloor here in the Atlantic, but it can be traced in sort of a Y-shaped pattern here in the Indian and on up into the Pacific Ocean. And in fact, we've come to realize there's a small segment of it up here as well. Now, it was called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge here in the Atlantic. It was very convenient. It was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Studied primarily by geologists based here on the East Coast at Woods Hole and Lamont, here in the Pacific, scientists out of San Diego studied this region and named it the East Pacific Rise, the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean rising from the seafloor. Well, it was a long time before geologists realized that, in fact, it was one continuous feature, and then the names ridges and rises are now used interchangeably. Once we've come to understand something about what is happening in terms of processes and what we infer is happening in terms of the whole global features. The other set of features that became very obvious were these arcuate-shaped, extremely deep areas of the ocean basin, located almost entirely in the Pacific, here in the Aleutians, down here along Japan, splitting next to the Philippines, out here in the Mariana Islands, down off Tonga, and then a few to Java, here in the region of Java here. These are features we call trenches, very deep. The deepest trench is the Mariana Trench. Out in this region, it reaches depths of 11,000 meters. Sort of asymmetric. These are very symmetric features. The ridges rising from the seafloor ridges. The trenches go down very steeply. Fortunately, on one side and extremely steeply on the other, but to very great depths. Now, Harry Hess's name up there. Harry Hess had sailed for the Navy for a number of years. Had been on shipboard making observations of these trends in the depths of the seafloor. It wasn't random, there were patterns, there were features that evolved. And Harry Hess, combined with the work of Wegener, took now a new understanding of global features because now we had information about the ocean base. And he postulated in a paper in 1962 the theory which we have now come to really see as the basis for what we understand in plate tectonics, but what he at the time, in a very modest sense, called geopoetry. And his story was that we have ridges where the crust is separating in the ocean. The crust is actually moving apart, and we have trenches where the crust is coming together. Now, that's just the story of the ocean. And so his theory, since his term of geopoetry, we've come to call his theory seafloor spreading. And what his theory says is, at these ridges, the seafloor is spreading apart, and at the trenches, the seafloor is converging. Well, that only deals with the seafloor, but remember, we had plates that were made in that map that I showed you in the beginning of both seafloor and continental crust. And so what we can see happening here in the Atlantic from his story is that not only is the seafloor spreading apart, but it's carrying with it any of the continental material, which may be attached. And Harry Hess really only had this data about what the seafloor features look like to put his story together. And he was very hesitant to propose it, but he proposed it at a time when all kinds of other technology had come along to study a whole new set of other data that's here on the seafloor. And rapidly, it took shape from his sort of crystallization of an idea that the seafloor must be spreading to the full-blown theory that we call plate tectonics. And before we take a break, I want to run through some of these other kinds of data which is sort of added together to put this picture all in place. Now, Hess had the idea, and Hess deserves all the credit for putting together how we could have continents moving with something going on the seafloor, but the cornerstone on which his theory rests was actually the result of two other scientists who were at Cambridge University years after Newton had been there, but still the same great source of all sorts of intellectual ideas, scientists named Matthews and his graduate student, whose last name is Vine. And Drummond Matthews studied the magnetism of rocks. Now we can go out and we can measure the magnetism of rocks on the continents by simply taking a sample back into our lab and seeing if it produces some kind of a magnetic field. But it turned out that in the oceans, we can also study the magnetism, but again, we had to develop certain kinds of devices. We can't go down there and just pick up our rocks. We have to measure the magnetism preserved in those rocks from some device on a ship. And we tow those devices behind ships. We call them magnetometers, just as we tow devices behind ships to produce sound. But before we look at the data that Matthews came back with, or the conclusions from his data, just a brief touch on the Earth's magnetic field. Remember, we think of the Earth as if it had a bar magnet in its middle. It doesn't. It's got circulating fluid, probably, that generates this magnetic field. But any rock that crystallizes at the surface of the Earth preserves whatever part of the Earth's magnetic field exists there. And the Earth's magnetic field, I don't know, I'm sure some of you have seen or played with, in fact, little iron filings and magnets. I mean, I can remember the games where you can put beards on a guy's face, right? I'm sure you've seen some of those. But the same kinds of things, we take a bar magnet, we find that the little iron filings would align themselves in this pattern. That's the field generated by the Earth. Well, the important thing is that we currently think of the Earth having a certain magnetic orientation that aligns with our north geographic pole, or closely aligned, so that not completely. But at times in the Earth's past, this has completely flipped. So the shape of the field might be the same, but instead of our north magnetic pole up here, we would have the north magnetic pole down here. And little particles in rock can in fact align themselves and pick up these changes in the Earth's magnetic field. And we call these reversals in the Earth's magnetic field, this flip-flop. Flip-flop over the last 70 million years has occurred irregularly, but on the average of about a million years. We're finding smaller and smaller sort of little mini reversals within that, but we can use this flip-flop, the global phenomenon, all the rocks recorded at the same time, to do some dating of rocks. Well, what Matthews came back with, and his graduate student Fred Vine was given the task of deciphering it, was a series of lines that went back and forth throughout an ocean basin across a ridge. And they could look at these little wiggles and see similarities in their wiggles of the magnetic properties of the rocks beneath to discover that there were patterns where the Earth's reversal of the magnetic field had been preserved in these rocks. And when they took and, in essence, contoured this information, they found out that there were bands of normal and reversed rock. Symmetric. And so these bands move out, and here they've been colored to indicate similar ages of rocks or the same reversal patterns that showed up in the rocks out there. The first study was actually done off here. This is, I'm sorry, I was focused on this side, but here we've got Columbia River coming out, the Straits of Wanatuka, Vancouver Island. So actually, the first study had been done off the coast here. But people didn't really realize that there was a ridge here. Hess hadn't put his story on paper. And so, in fact, this data was completely ignored, and the scientists who had put this data together and, in fact, contoured it to give it a map, something like this, spent the rest of his day packing shipping materials for a scientific project. Nobody believed it. But Fred Vine and Drummond Matthews, their data came from the Indian Ocean, but they very rapidly combined it with some data from the Atlantic Ocean. This is here just south of Iceland, to see this very symmetric pattern. Well, if we know that this is the crest of a ridge, and Harry has said this is where the new material is being created, then maybe what's happened is that older material is carrying out with it whether it was a reversed or a normal period in the Earth's magnetic field. And scientists very rapidly went and collected all this information